to GDPR Radio. My name is Ollie Rear. I am the host for these sessions. But we're doing something a little bit different this week. We recorded this episode 22nd of October, this week's podcast, but we're doing a pre-recorded intro to this one, Miles and I. It's a little bit different, but we hope that it's slightly more concise, and you don't have to sit through all the usual, you know, admin that we get through on the podcast. But it was a good session this week. Plenty of interaction, wasn't it, Miles?
Tons of interaction from everybody, and plenty of chatter inside the chat as well.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. It's just what we like. We covered some really interesting topics. We spoke at length about particularly the use of biometrics in schools, the processing of children's data. We spoke a lot about CCTV as well, and also more broadly, just about ongoing news and views, as we always do on these sessions. So we hope you'll enjoy this podcast recording. Let us know if you like these intros recorded after the fact, and if not, we'll do away with them if you don't like them. Next week's session, as you will hear, is dedicated to the charity sector. We're very excited to be welcoming our partners at NoChecks onto that one because they've got some great experience to share. The topic of which, Miles, is re-engaging with lapsed donors, right?
That's correct. We've worked quite closely with a lot of the charities within our community to find out what the main challenges are. And that was one of the challenges that was raised by a lot of the people who we work with. So we'll be discussing how to re-engage with lapsed donors.
Absolutely. So if you want an invite to that next week for the live session, do let us know. Get in touch with Miles or any of us, really. Brian, Rob, or if in doubt, support@datawithprotectionpeople.com. You can catch us on that if you would like an invite to a live session. But if not, we will be recording it as we have with all of the podcasts thus far and putting it out. So yeah, any further info, you can get in touch with us. Likewise, for any of the links or documents that we discussed on today's session, if you want any of them, just reach out to myself, Miles, or any of the guys. Anything else to add, Miles?
No, that's about it, Ollie. Let's get started.
Well, in that case, I hope you all enjoy the session, and I will leave you in the very capable hands of Phil Brining, David Holmes, and I guess myself.
Perfect.
Without further ado, I suggest that we get stuck in. So we'll start with a few bits and pieces that have been in the news. There's quite a lot, actually, to get into this week. Weirdly, there's a bit of a theme along lines both of children's data and facial recognition. Some of you may already know where we're going with some of these, but if not, we'll get to those very shortly. But the first thing on my list, Dave, is the regulator of social housing's risk profile that you mentioned this morning. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was quite interested to kind of keep up to date with what's happening in some of the sectors that we work quite heavily across. And we've recently, I think it was published a handful of days ago now, the sector risk profile for 2021. As published by the regulator of social housing. I'm more than happy to, if nobody's got a copy of it, you can pick up through Googling, but I'll try and pop a link into the chat for anybody who wishes to pick it up. But I was quite interested to see that within the wider risk strategy, that it calls out data integrity and data security in particular, which was of interest because obviously we're data protection specialists in the world of privacy, and data integrity is one of the data protection principles, and likewise data security is one of the data protection principles as well. And it was interesting to kind of just read around those areas as part of a wider risk profile. And then it kind of also reiterates within there that providers must comply with the Data Protection Act 2018 in that sense. So it's kind of coming more to a fruition. I was quite glad to see that it was in there. And I just wondered if anybody else had kind of picked up on that or seen something similar within other standards potentially.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's always good to see regulators for a particular sector sort of including this as one of the things that we should be aware of, because all too often it may not get the traction it deserves if it's not actually practically enforced by a regulator. We see this in the education sector, actually, in particular, which I guess is kind of relevant because we're going to be talking a little bit about education sector matters shortly. But, you know,
We do, and the other bit that interests me as well is some regulators, obviously aware from the Information Commissioner's Office, that are actively pursuing compliance with other areas of the law. Because anecdotally, you kind of, well, in my eyes at least, we do or often see there's a difference in the level of compliance between organisations that are regulated by other regulators that are looking at this, not necessarily just the ICO in that sense, with the governance measures, possibly just the areas that I look at within the clients that I work with, but their governance measures tend to be better through enforcement through other regulators that they've got to be accountable to.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at, is that currently, you know, as far as I'm aware, the Data Protection Act and the wider GDPR, wider data protection standards, are not currently something which is checked by Ofgem in the education sector. Ofsted, in the education sector. And, well, I guess, you know, what's the incentive if it's not going to be enforced? So, no, definitely good to see. Phil, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that particular piece of news or if there's anything else you wanted to raise in particular.
No, not particularly. I thought it was a bit weak as the sector risk profile. You know, it's quite strong on security, but you know, data integrity is its main driver rather than compliance with data protection law. You know, in terms of the integrity piece, and you know, we've been doing a lot of work with HACT and with MRI, and we've published a few ebooks, and you know that's you know, the data integrity piece is mostly focused, in my view, in this context, on information about properties being up to date, so you know, and fire certificates being up to date, rather than tenant information being up to date, because that was the emphasis of all the work we've done with HACT and the other guys on these WebEx we've done.
I've just uploaded the link to the sector profile risk. The sector risk profile. So if anybody is looking for a copy of that, I've just uploaded the link to the chat there for you, Ollie.
It's saying that, I mean, it does say on 3.32, all providers must comply with the Data Protection Act 2018, you know, and but that's under the heading of data security.
Lovely stuff. Well, thanks for uploading that, Dave. It's very helpful. Well, I'll tell you what, let's stick in the general remit of children's data, because I mentioned at the start we've got a couple of things that we want to cover. One of the ones, Dave, that you flagged this morning is that you noticed that the New Zealand Bank, or Bank of New Zealand, correct me if I'm wrong on that, published recently some privacy information targeted at children, but in the form of quite a good video, you said, which is interesting because it's something which I think the ICO in particular have reiterated as an option and a particularly interesting and viable option on a number of occasions, but is actually pretty rare, really.
For sure. It's kind of spiked my interest for kind of a good couple of reasons, really, because it's something we've looked at probably in different ways. In particular, it's like training and education. When we're offering training to people, training's often probably delivered in English, probably taught, so it's spoken. But then, is training inclusive in the sense that are we thinking about the wider audience? Are we thinking about making sure that individuals with any form of learning or engagement difficulties, if you want to term it that way, would be getting the same level of training? And because I've been thinking about that area for a while, it kind of sparked me interest in line with delivering privacy information as well. And when you start thinking about privacy information and the traditional forms that you see, which is text in a Word document or text on a screen, whether that's being inclusive to the wider audience or the wider customer base that you may have, and how you might be able to represent in this in different ways. And it's something I'd come across many years ago, actually. I'd forgotten, I'd remembered about it. And I think, and I'll put both of the links into the chat shortly. Channel 4 did a video on their privacy many moons ago. talking about it. I think at that point, Alan Carr was involved. And I just thought, well, actually, that's quite an engaging way to do it, isn't it? If somebody wants to look to or understand what your privacy is, why do we stick to traditional text formats? Yes, we've got to be clear. Yes, we've got to be transparent. We've got to be open about what we're doing. But does that necessarily need to be replicated in text format on in a Word document on the website? Does it need to be typed necessarily onto a Word onto a website page? And should we be looking at more engaging ways to drive people or to engage with people or create interest in actually reviewing policy documents by doing it in a bit of a fun and interesting way that might be more inclusive to the audience, especially when you consider a range of different difficulties that people may have with interpreting the information that you push out there. So I think it's, I thought it was quite interesting. I'll put both of the links in the, it's a YouTube link, the one I've got to put into the chat, but I'll just sync it into the link. So you've got that one. That one's for the BNZ, which is the Bank of New Zealand. And there's another one for Channel 4. There may well be other ones around. So if there are any other ones, please feel free to pop them into the chat. They're always quite interesting to see, just to see different ways that they can be delivered in that sense. Do let me know if those links work, by the way.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, Alan's saying that apparently Jet2 also used something similar. And Leslie saying that they tried to do it a while back, make some, you know, GDPR video material, but something the organisation didn't want to do. So perhaps time to push for that again. I think particularly if you do... Sorry, Phil.
I was going to say, the Jet2 one's quite good, actually, because when I last looked at it anyway, it might have changed. It was a cabin crew sort of talking you through. It was quite well done, actually.
Mm. Well, that's the way to do it. I mean, make it engaging at the end of the day. There's nothing that's going to switch people off more than a big block of text of this is what we do with your data. I mean, as Dave says, you know, you still have to be comprehensive and transparent, but there's no need to bore people to death either with it, because that's kind of going to have the adverse effect.
Likewise, but like I said, that my whole premise wasn't necessarily just the form. It's how you make it inclusive. You may have sections across your base that have got low attainment levels in education, for example, or might not have English as a first language, or may not have, or may have sight or hearing or other form of disabilities. That may mean trying to engage with the standard form text is not necessarily going to be understandable to them, because they can't engage in the material in the format in which you're pushing it out.
Oh, I saw someone get fined for privacy notices being in the wrong language or not in appropriate language.
Spot on, Phil. It was in the Netherlands, I think.
Yeah, it was Holland, I think. Yeah. I'll try and dig it out.
But you're absolutely right. Oh, thanks, Alan, for popping that video, that Jet2 one in the chat. You're spot on, Dave, because I mentioned this morning in our call, you know, it brought back memories of prior to working here in a number of years now. I was doing some work with a pretty large charity, one that specializes in advice. You can infer which one that is going to be. But we used to have a lot of people come into the sort of walk-in surgery who had either very basic or very limited or no English at all sometimes. And all of the data processing in that case was predicated off of consent. They were given a consent form to sign. They were sat down and talked through it. But that, you know, thinking back on it now, obviously I didn't really know at the time, it was prior to me getting into the industry, you know, absolutely not appropriate at all, because, you know, if you can't understand what you're being asked about, consent certainly is going to be out the window. Joe's found that link, Phil. It was TikTok.
Yeah,
apparently.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, it spiked me interest this morning when I saw that. So it's I just thought it was worth raising and see if anybody does. Does anybody, obviously this is your session as well, does anybody want to unmute? Does anybody do anything different? Does anybody have any fun and interesting ways to either obtain or disclose information on the processing activities, for example? It's always interesting to see what's going on out there. So if you feel like unmuting and joining in, please feel free to do so. You're more than welcome to.
Yeah, do dive in. If not, then the next thing I wanted to talk about, just to set us up, while anyone who does want to dive in does so, is this business about facial recognition being used in certain schools in England. as part of, you know, trying to speed up and maintain a contactless approach to lunch payments for kids. Again, this is something that was raised this morning. I think there's probably quite a lot to talk about on that front. Dave, I don't know, we discussed it very briefly, but I mean, there's a lot to unpack here.
There is. It seems to be a little bit of an extension. It's in essence the same kind of thing. So there is a bit of a link to what I'm going to say next. But there seems to be an extension because I've certainly become aware of school meals and how you track individuals and payment for school meals in order to stop children walking around school with cash and possibly being open to bullying and all that kind of thing. And I'm aware that some schools actually use fingerprint recognition devices to link it to, in essence, the cash account, if you like, or the dinner money account. So I've certainly seen it in practice with fingerprints, but not facial recognition. I know that's come up recently within in the privacy world, but in essence, it's still using biometric information for the purposes of identifying you, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. So I guess, would you rather it be your fingerprints or facial recognition? Does it really make a difference in practice? I don't know. It's definitely stirred up quite a strong opposition to it, this, as far as I can tell. And I think probably rightly so. I think it's probably unnecessary.
I'm not at all comfortable. I stand to be shot down about this, but about using biometric information for security anyway, in general, because once it gets compromised, well, the cat's out of the bag, isn't it? I mean, all you need to do is reproduce electronic copy of the code that forms the fingerprint or the facial features, and you're in. So, you know, you can't change your fingerprints and you can't change your face easily.
Yeah.
You can't change your password and your token.
It's also possibly interesting to see what they might do with that facial print, because last week we talked about the 7-Eleven stores in Australia that were doing facial recognition for the purposes of filling out a survey in store. And I think there's about 1.6 million people took part in around, I think there's about 700 stores in Australia that was running this facial recognition thing in order to take a survey. Now, that the facial recognition was calculated into or produced into a face print in order to be pushed into the cloud, but they're actually using the face print to infer age and gender. So it's not just seeing how often you've provided good feedback, and have you provided good feedback however many times the last 20 minutes in order to affect the system, or whether staff were given good feedback in order to affect the system, but they're then inferring age and gender. So is that not then taking it further than the initial purpose?
Well, it is. And one of the issues I saw was being debated was desensitizing young people to facial recognition. So it becomes an acceptable way of capturing information about you know that age group, and as they grow up, they'll, you know, where that's the end of a wedge. So I agree with that, actually. You know, it might be all right in isolated cases, let's say, and bearing in mind the police, Metropolitan Police, were refused the use of facial recognition for crime prevention when they were monitoring that area of King's Cross. But you know, should we be desensitizing young people to intrusive processing? I think
it's a very valid point that you make, because in essence what you're trying to do is normalize it. Once it becomes normalized that
that's
people
the
do
word
that,
I was looking for. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Then once you've normalized it, then you get less objection to it. So then
why would your employer not do it? If your school can do it, why wouldn't your employer do it?
Precisely.
And is the school meal service contracted out? You know, is it?
It is.
So you can imagine employers saying, well, why don't we use facial recognition in order to give access to secure areas instead of swipe cards and badges?
Or not, how to open the fridge to get your sandwiches out.
that might appeal to Jasmine. She had a sandwich nicked out of the communal fridge the other week, so, so she might be quite pro that.
Yeah, I forgot to apologise to Jasmine for that.
Deary me, Dave. There's a lot of interaction in the chat. Michael attached this story as shared a quote from Fraser Sampson, Biometrics Commissioner for England and Wales. If there is a less intrusive way, that should be used. So that means pretty clear cut, isn't it? Let's be honest. I'm just trying to keep up. Yeah, I do apologise. There's a flurry of interaction over that. It's always the way. No one has anything to say, and I sort of lose track of it, and then all of a sudden everyone wants to contribute. Should tell us where the more interesting points are, shouldn't it, really?
One interesting point that might come up, Ollie, without trying to cut across you there, is what's the lawful basis are they operating under?
Well, it's literally what I was about to say. Is Alan quite rightly raises hard to stand up against an Article 9 lawful basis for it. The one what I read from the article in this facial recognition case, they reckon that 97% of pupils and parents or carers had provided consent. And I also saw a story which sort of said that they had to give consent, I think, which is quite I always find that a strange turn of phrase when people say, oh, they have to give consent. I know what they're getting at in most cases, but it sort of just rings a little bit.
Just the wording to have to give consent seems to remove the ability for it to be freely given.
Yeah, absolutely. There were points here made, Phil, in relation to what you were saying about effectively compromising, the code behind it, and therefore then as a security measure, it's basically redundant, but you can't change it. I don't know if that's something that, if you keep an eye on the chat, you wanted to dive into.
I saw the comments. I've seen the comments. I don't know enough about the technology behind it. It just worries me though that, it just worries me.
No, I take your point, and it is concerning. I was trying to keep up at the time, so I wasn't really listening. But I didn't contribute rather than not listening. But I completely agree with what you were both saying, in that one of the big risks surely is going to be desensitizing and normalizing this type of relatively intrusive measure for a younger generation. Because as soon as you build it in at a young age, It starts to become normalised, as you rightly say.
It's quite interesting from the stat that you gave as well. If 97% of pupils and parents have already given consent, does that mean it's already normalised?
Well, that quite possibly. Kerry says that they do have to give consent. They get sent a whole wedge of paperwork about this and have to give written permission, which is kept and can be revoked at any time. I mean, I'm not. I'm not criticising the consent. I'm sure it's a perfectly valid one. I always just find the turn of phrase "have to give consent" quite amusing. You'll have to forgive me. But I'd be curious to know sort of how this is something that often interests me. Is we talk about consent, and you can get a valid GDPR consent not as more easily than it's often made out to be. And I'm not entirely sure how informed it often is. I guess that's what Michael's getting at. How informed is a lot of this consent? Are you just saying, yes, it's fine, off you go, tick a box, I'll sign the form for you? It's often something that interests me. I'm happy to be challenged
it might be informed in respect of this is what we're doing and why we're doing it, but go a step further and these are the consequences of it going wrong, or these are the consequences of something else. I can't imagine that's particularly, again, I'm making this up as I'm going along, but I can't imagine that that's particularly explicit in any information given out, unless Carrie's saying, well, there's a big wadge of stuff and it's all highlighting the potential risks that might arise.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
I don't know about you, my computer has got some basic facial recognition, and I think it's going to come more and more. Imagine if it was in your car, you get in your car, it recognizes who you are and away you go, or that with a combination of fingerprints.
Well, there's already that because you can, if you've got the, I'm assuming Androids do as well, but you've got the iPhone, you can access your iPhone through your facial recognition. You can access your bank details through saying, yes, accept facial recognition for accessing your bank accounts in order to remove the having to keep putting a pin in. So there's already a degree of normalization happening already just through the computer that's in your pocket, let alone what's set up in a school.
I wonder if there's any twins in the school. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Hmm. Yeah, actually, Alan, again, makes a good point, which is there's been actually relatively limited commentary on what the children actually think of all this, which is a pretty good take, because I'm happy to take your view on it, Alan, if you want to jump in. But I suspect that the children either aren't going to have a sufficiently good understanding of it to be able to have an opinion, or they're not going to care that much, because I think genuinely at that age, you're not that interested in all that sort of thing. I think it's probably difficult to to grasp the severity of it. I'm happy to be challenged on that. I don't claim to be an expert, but yeah, it's interesting to see. Steph also raises a good point. This is one that I wanted to get onto today because I've noticed that Tesco have opened their first payless and tillless store, as Amazon have been doing. And Steph raises the point about video and self-scan tills in supermarkets, which I guess is kind of tangentially related. But again, this is going to continue to develop. Alan, do you want to jump in? Sorry, I can see your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. One of the reasons I asked that was I suspect we underestimate the knowledge of certainly some children about this kind of thing. When my daughter was in sixth form, which is about 10, 12 years ago, they introduced a really quite intrusive proximity pass system that to track when everybody came into school and what classes they were in, et cetera, et cetera. Within a week, there was basically the pupils are brought down the system by agreeing to swap passes three times a day, which I was well impressed by. And as far as I can gather, without any kind of adult supervision, they brought down the system within a week. So I'd just be interested to know what the children think, because I suspect they're possibly a bit more engaged with it than we give them credit for.
Yeah, quite possibly. Maybe I'm being unfair. Yeah, Carrie's saying that they do occasionally get parents to sign they don't want their child's fingerprint being used, and there's no issue with that. The information goes into quite a lot of detail about how the fingerprint scan is processed into a barcode and the security of the storage and sharing information, but not about it going wrong. So, I mean, it sounds like it's being done to quite a high standard, and I wouldn't expect any less, quite frankly. I think probably the real issue is, again, it creeping in, and is it actually proportionate and necessary, I suppose.
But No, absolutely. I was just going to contrast that from what may appear to be quite a high standard in some cases too. And again, without going back onto the 7-Eleven case, but just because I just found it interesting with some of the arguments put forward by 7-Eleven, was that they're not collecting personal information as it was stored in the cloud and only handled by the service provider. So it's...
Yeah, for sure. Andrew also raises a good point, which is whether, in a lot of this, whether we need to give more time and consideration to children in particular who have additional needs, whether that's something, more diagnosable and recognised, like a learning difficulty or a learning disability, or just generally children who are potentially more neurodiverse and need a little bit more support around that. Yeah, it's a complex issue. I mean, there's no straight answer to it. I guess we covered the 7-Eleven point that you wanted to make, Dave. I don't know if there's anything else you want to.
It was more just kind of looking at the facial recognition and some of the what they were doing around that. Like I say, it's more just the responses they gave. I indicated there that they said that they weren't collecting personal data, but they also said that they weren't involved. So you kind of get this element of a dataless controller. In that sense, because it's not us doing it, it's them in that kind of argument, in the sense that they're trying to, in essence, I guess, trying to contract outside of our obligations in that sense. And the only other final one, which is a rather weak argument, I think, was the fact that they were saying that they weren't facial prints weren't personal data, as they were not being used to identify, track or monitor, which seems to be contrary to the purpose of what they were there for. But if that's going to be your defence, do go and read it, anybody who's interested, do go and read it. It's about the 7-Eleven in Australia in that sense. And they just maybe start thinking then about looking at things like how do you identify people? Because we're going back to what is personal data in the GDPR being the individual's got to be directly or indirectly identified or identifiable in that kind of sense, and the information must relate to them. And it then got me thinking about the fact that some people don't necessarily see like the cookies and all the online tracking as personal data, because you can't actually specifically identify somebody in their eyes by like a name and an address. So then it comes to identifiability in that sense. And just I was just going to kick around without going on for too long about it, but about identifiability, being able to distinguish one from another, not necessarily knowing the name and address. But if you can distinguish one from another in essence, single them out and interact with them in a different way, then it's personal data, because you can identify somebody. You don't necessarily need the name and address or contact details for that sheer purpose. But that again just comes onto some of the elements that I come across with some of my clients around identifiability. And I thought kind of a bit of an intenuous link, but starting off with 7-Eleven through to identifiability and what is personal data.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I've had a number of arguments with marketing departments of some of my clients, where some of you may remember, long-term listeners may remember that there was a period of a few months back where I was having a good old moan about a new piece of kit one of them wants to start using, which effectively was all about app installation attribution. And basically you do a lot of that through collecting the ID for advertisers on Apple devices, I think it's called, and then there's an equivalent on Google. It's like it's basically user ID, and it's an individual identification number that sits on your phone and allows you to be distinguished from other users. And for a long time there was an argument that was attempted, at least, which was that that's not personal data. And I was sort of saying, well, I don't see in what way it's not personal data. It's an identifier which allows you to distinguish one user from another and associate their activity, you know, with this one particular user. How is it not personal data? It's difficult. Because to me, it seemed pretty obvious, but apparently not.
For sure.
I noticed there are a couple of bits again in the chat. Marcus shared a link to that story I raised previously about the Tesco sort of. I don't know what you call these cashless stores. They're not cashless, I suppose, but they're, you know, no tillless, maybe. I don't know. These stores where you walk in and basically help yourself. It's fascinating technology, but it's interesting to dig into. Cameron's also raised again something I've seen this week, but not really had a chance to grapple with properly, which is the new Saudi data protection law. I've heard a lot of noise about that. I wouldn't wish to get myself into any kind of trouble, but as with the China privacy bill that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, some of these nations that have potentially not the best human rights records, introducing privacy laws comes off as potentially slightly disingenuous. Actually, to add to that, I did notice this week that despite China's brand new privacy law, which is very advanced and very good in a lot of ways, that they have decided they're going to ban the Quran app from the App Store. Put in a request to Google and now you can't download it in China. I don't think I need to say any more on that, and I probably shouldn't before I get myself into trouble.
I'd be interested if Cameron wants to jump on to see whether I've seen you shared a link in the chat, but whether you've done any kind of comparison with what the Saudi data protection law is versus kind of the differences with that and the GDPR. I'm aware of it, and I'm kind of basically trying to cheat the system. I've not looked at it. I just wondered if you could expand on maybe what some of it might contain. But so do feel free to jump in and just give us an overview if necessary. And if not, then I'll follow the link and read it for myself.
Yeah, Dave. To be honest, I haven't done any in-depth research. I've only looked through that one trust article. But it's quite interesting because there's obviously a lot of similarities between GDPR and you're seeing quite a few of privacy laws now where they're effectively copying and pasting and shifting and lifting, you know, the GDPR text into their own privacy law. So it's quite interesting from that perspective. As Ollie says, obviously, it's, you know, how rigorously enforced that's going to be is going to be another matter. But one of the things I did find particularly interesting in the OneTrust article was the fine regime, and they've actually included obviously a monetary fine, but they've also included an imprisonment of up to 2 years if you're in breach of certain articles of the law. So I found that was particularly interesting, but. Yeah, I can't claim to be any sort of expert as such, but that OneTrust article is quite good at breaking it down.
No, brilliant. Thanks for sharing. I'll certainly will go and read that. I was hoping to try and circumvent some of the reading, but I'll go and read it for myself.
Yeah, no. To be fair, they've summarised it quite well. It's quite a brief. It's not too much of a read, but yeah. It, like I say, generally they have just lifted and shifted GDPR. To be honest.
And I think that's a very valid point as well. I think I've seen in other laws that are coming through kind of looking to the GDPR being the gold standard, whether it is or it isn't, but everybody's kind of trying to align to that standard to a greater or lesser degree. So you do see a lot of similarities at times. So I would agree with the point that you're making there. What's on paper is not necessarily what's going to be enforced.
Absolutely. And one of the other things I found interesting, I did look at this in a little bit more detail for work purposes. I was looking to see whether UAE had a data protection law the other day, and they don't actually have a law that covers the whole state. But interestingly, I did find that they've got a specific data protection law that applies to one of these sort of financial institutions that they have in UAE. And that was effectively a lift and shift of GDPR. But I thought that was the first time I've ever seen a data protection legislation which applies to a specific institution and not either specific areas of like public authorities or private sector, but specifically to one sort of type of institution, which I thought was really, really interesting. But yeah.
No, for sure. The other bit that it makes me think as well, and I'm only just thinking on the hoof with this, is if around the world privacy laws are kind of mimicking each other to a greater or lesser degree, what's people's views and stance on the UK government's kind of going, well, forget all that, we'll try and diverge a bit. Do you think that's necessarily the right track to take? Or do you think there's areas of it that, to be fair, there's probably bits that could be tweaked, could be improved? But in essence, we all ought to kind of keep that similar kind of level of playing field. It'd be interesting to see what either your thoughts are that and Cameron, anybody else's really.
Go on. No, you go. You're the guest on it.
Sorry for jumping in. But I think from my point of view, from the UK perspective, I think it's interesting because obviously our adequacy decision has been based on the fact that we're essentially equivalent to EU GDPR. I think some of the proposals in the in the DCMS documentation could potentially mean that the EU might disagree with some of those changes and mean that people have less rights to privacy. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to watch. As you say, other countries are mimicking EU GDPR. As we move away, that could have some effect on us. But obviously, we'll have to just wait and see what happens, I think.
No, for sure. It's certainly one I'm keeping an eye on. I'm a little bit cynical about it. I think there's some bits that have probably been put in to the consultation paper to attract you to kind of go, well, why would you want to get rid of that but keep the essence of it? And I think they've probably put bits in there that they know is going to be challenged that they can then back down on to say that we've listened to you. But that's maybe telling everybody a little bit more about my cynical self as opposed to necessarily the direction of the law.
No, well, I think you're probably right, Dave. I can't understand the idea of diluting it anyway or watering it down. Like, yes, tweaking and amending, yeah, let's do that. But if we are in a place where a lot of us are pretty close, if not already compliant with the highest standard in the world, why would we want to dilute that? That puts us in such a strong position internationally if everyone else is trying to, play catch up and meet our standards. Let's stick to that. I don't understand why we would want to move. Well, I do know why we want to move away from it. It's primarily political, I would argue, but,
sound bites as opposed to anything else.
Exactly. There's a lot of chatter on the chat, funnily enough, about the Ring doorbell issue from last week, because we did talk about that very briefly, didn't we, Dave?
We did.
Basically, the fact that there has been a county court judgment that has effectively awarded damages to a neighbour of someone who was using a Ring doorbell, and it was deemed to be completely disproportionate and intrusive. The fine, the damages rather, are astronomic. It's like 100 grand, which is, again, this is what it can be so frustrating with the privacy landscape and the enforcement landscape in this country, is that when you have large organizations that are barely being fined and then a private individual comes along and he gets slapped with 100 grand's worth of damages, it's just so inconsistent and it's so frustrating. Like, why can't you apply that aggression in your interpretation of the law and in your enforcement to, the people who really, well, not the people, the organisations who are really, making a nuisance of themselves. That's one of my big gripes with it. I personally think, it's going to have to be appealed, surely, you would think. I think it probably will shift the landscape on this sort of thing. For those of you who are involved in particularly the housing sector, but also potentially, you know, local government or anyone that's involved in instances where we get a lot of these Ring doorbells or just general domestic CCTV systems, you'll know how much of a pain they are. They're an absolute nightmare to deal with. I think ultimately reining a lot of this in is going to be a good thing, but I just think the inconsistency almost in it is frustrating. I don't know, Dave, if you want to jump in on that at all.
Yeah, for sure. I've just put the link into the case so you can access the case. It was a county court case at Oxford between Dr. Mary Fairhurst and John Woodward. So do go and please read the article. It's the Daily Mail. I think it was led with the Daily Mail or somebody. I think it was kind of going, it's Ring doorbells. But I think he also had a range of other CCTV cameras up. So I don't think it was just 100 grand for having the Ring doorbell. I think there's other cameras up as well, if I remember rightfully, in his back garden, possibly looking over opposition, yeah. So he could possibly view other neighbours in their gardens too. So it's not limited to the doorbell.
I think you're spot on, Dave. I think I haven't read this, so I'm happy to be corrected by anyone who has read it. But I think a key here is we're not talking about just a guy who has a Ring doorbell. I think it was particularly disproportionate and intrusive, as far as I'm aware, which probably means that it's not going to be too applicable a precedent, really, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, with it being a county court, it won't be precedent either, in that sense. I could imagine at 100 grand it'll be appealed anyway, but it's not a court level where it'd set a precedent for anybody to follow. They might look to it, but they certainly won't be set at a precedent at a county court level.
Apparently Joe said it was more than just cameras. It was also sort of deliberate harassment and skulking around, taking recordings and sharing it with others. And this is the thing with a lot of this, because ultimately, you know, the Ring doorbell and the domestic CCTV system can be a, Cameron also says audio involved, can be a really good tool. And obviously, you know, we all understand why people would want these in place, you know, secure your home, etc. The problem is that all too often that then starts to spiral and you get into this, particularly where you're involved in neighbour disputes. And for anyone who's ever had issues with their neighbours in any, you know, tenancy or any place they've ever lived, they'll know that things can spiral so quickly, and things which are otherwise completely innocuous and inane all of a sudden become absolutely intolerable, you know, and the worst and most heinous crime. You know, you decide to play music ever so slightly too loud and these things just spiral. And that's kind of where I think a lot of the problem is in these close proximity scenarios. You will have seen many of them, I assume, Dave, in your work in social housing.
Yes, no, I've seen a lot, and I think you're absolutely spot on that. I think it's trying to contain the spiral, and I've certainly seen the explosion in people wanting to use Ring doorbells. And just picking up really on Cameron's point as well, I think it was actually within the case and things that they were actually saying that it could pick up sound from, I think it was like 40 feet away. So then you've not just got the ability to collectively, if you wanted to, have Ring doorbells between several people in a block or around a block, but with the audio coverage that it covers as well, and I think there's kind of an element of intrusiveness there. But I think a lot of it was sound bites by the press, 100 grand potentially. Ring doorbells, exactly. And there's a lot of focus on that element without understanding the wider implications of the other bits, like what Joe mentioned about all the harassment and various other cameras and bits and pieces. It's a collective, it's not just the Ring doorbell that's the issue within the case.
And that's exactly what Ian's saying, is that apparently one of the cameras and microphones was entirely covering a neighbour's property, and in Ian's opinion, ruling was fair and headline. Misleading GDPR bashing, well, that's hardly a change of pace, is it? It's to be expected at this point, the dreaded GDPR. There's one I want to pick up here, actually. I don't know, Alan, if you want to come back on again, because I've not picked up on this. I've not noticed this. I don't know if anyone else has. The issue of Amazon Sidewalk sharing Wi-Fi networks with others in the neighbourhood unless people opt out, which, unless I'm misunderstanding, surely sounds like a massive security concern for your home networks. I've not even opened the article, Alan, to be honest. I don't know if you want to fill us in on that a little bit.
I've not read anything about it for a while, and I'm not sure how universal it is. The story, I think, was based in the US. Unless you tell it not to, Amazon will hook up with any other Wi-Fi devices in the neighborhood and basically set up their own network.
Surely so, that'll be with only open Wi-Fi, will it, Alan?
Absolutely no idea. I'm not using it, so I haven't bothered to check out the terms and conditions.
No, fair enough. But I mean, it'd hardly be surprising. Rick saying that apparently it's not enabled in the UK, so it must just be a US thing. But again, it's one of these things. This is, I think, what can really sort of, well, personally, I'm going to say, can get me down a lot about this, is that sometimes these things come out, these stories about something which is horribly intrusive or whatever it might be, and you're just not surprised anymore a lot of the time. You just sort of sat there almost expecting it.
It's funny you mentioned about the, and it's only a bit of a tenuous link on the intrusiveness bit, but you were going to mention the recent fine, weren't you, in Scotland?
Yes, I was actually. I don't know if anyone else has seen this, but this is a good point, Dave, actually. I don't know if anyone else has seen this. I think it came out this morning, and it was, in all honesty, our very own Joe Kirk who brought this to my attention, which is that HIV Scotland have been fined £10,000 for basically for a breach. Essentially, they sent out a bulk email to, I think, about 100 odd people, and in a turn of events which will make everyone on the call tear their hair out, no doubt, they CC'd everyone instead of BCC'ing. It's most simple and basic way to have a quite sizable data breach. And it basically included email addresses of people who were patient advocates for those who are HIV positive in Scotland. And therefore, it was possible to infer that, you know, those individual status potentially. So they were fined £10,000. But what's interesting about that is, you raised this, Dave, instantly you made the link, is that this happened to an NHS trust about 6 years ago, right?
It was, and there's a sizable difference in the fine that was awarded. I don't know if anybody can remember, but it's an NHS trust fined for a 56 Dean Street HIV status leak, and that clinic was sending out a newsletter in 2015, that in essence had also sent the email with courtesy copies to the email base. So I think it sent to about 800 people, or just shy of about 800 people in all. Not everybody on the email base had HIV in that sense, but you could make inferences to it. The clinic itself stressed that not all people received the newsletter were HIV positive, and 730 of the email addresses on the list contain full names of their owners in that sense. The fine in that sense, it was a newsletter, like I said, it certainly wasn't HIV test results, it was just a newsletter from the clinic in that sense, but they were fined 180,000 back in 2015.
But again, obviously the inference is that if you're on that mailing list, that in all likelihood you're at least more likely than not to be affected in some way by HIV. There are a couple of people, Mark and Andrew, are quite rightly outraged by it. I mean, it's so disappointing, you know, when you've got something that is so sensitive that you'd be so callous about sharing it like that. You mentioned, Dave, why are you not just using, you know, some sort of, not to push any particular products, but why are you not just using some mailing platform like MailChimp or DotMailer or something just to cut out that risk solely?
And if not,
then why on earth are your DLP measures not set up properly? It's just baffling. You know as well as I do, and in fact, you more so than I do, because you've seen it and you've told me about this. You know, how many instances have you seen where you go into an organisation and they've got DLP available to them and it's just not configured or used because no one knows what it does?
No, for sure. There's a really good couple of key points in that that I thought would be worth kind of kicking around. I mean, you're right. Time again, you're kind of going, we're still fining people for copying people in, not using blind courtesy copy when you're sending out emails to kind of more than to one recipient in that sense. And that always kind of frustrates me. Why are we putting BCC? Why are we copying 800 people into a BCC email? Why don't we use in essence, an email broadcast platform that sends each individual individually. You can schedule a thing to run, you can set it in advance, you can do all the, well, you've got more functionality with it than you would do through Outlook in that sense. It gives you a delivery report, so you know which ones have been delivered, which ones are bounced back, so you can kind of keep your data integrity and data cleansing operations going on in that sense. You give the people the ability to unsubscribe, which you don't do, which Outlook can't. So why the hell are we still using Outlook for sending mass email communications? And if you are, then you really ought to make sure that your DLP is configured and other measures to stop this kind of thing from happening. It's happened too many times for people to still be getting caught by it, in my eyes. I think it's potentially quite negligent, quite frankly, in that sense, because there's technology out there, and it's not expensive technology either. When I was in direct marketing many moons ago, and I was doing email marketing an email broadcast platform, I maybe shouldn't look, I'm endorsing a product, through an email broadcast platform, I think it worked out in essence to be about a penny an email. It's nothing, you know what I mean?
Nothing.
It's just... Anyway, get off me rant. But yeah,
it's fine. you get back up on that soapbox if you want, Dave. That's what we're all here for.
But it's just infuriating because it comes back to links a lot of the elements that I'm trying to include and have tried to include a lot within the training that we deliver, in the sense that when you're talking data protection, trying to get people switched on to data protection. Data protection is not just information within a database. It's not just printed matter in that sense. What we're talking about with data protection ultimately is people and their private lives and our impact upon that when we get it wrong. And if people were more mindful of the fact that we're talking about people and we're talking about private lives, and potentially this could be your mum, it could be your nan, it could be your children, that kind of stuff. If you get to the fact that we're dealing with people in their private lives, and that's, if we misuse it, that's got a potential impact upon that, people might start switching on a little bit more to the fact that data protection isn't one of those dry subjects that sit in the back and we have to trot out some training every now and then. It's actually quite serious in that sense. That's not necessarily looking to the other elements of being privacy intrusive and things, but it's just the fact that whatever we're doing with personal data means we're dealing with people and that kind of stuff. And if we don't do things with it properly, then we're going to have an impact upon that. And we need to be more switched on and thinking about it in those lines, in that sense.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, absolutely. Steph says, good, well-informed rant, David. Applause. And Mark suggesting that you need a glass of water to calm down.
I'll step off my soapbox. I'll put it away for a little time being.
I get this every day, Mark. Consider yourself lucky. unfortunately, Steph, I do not have an answer to your question, what does innovation mean? That's slightly beyond me at lunchtime on a Friday. It's a very good point, though, because a lot of it's interesting because a lot of the work in that DCMS paper or consultation that was focused on innovation and particularly everything around AI research, I don't know if anyone else felt this, but it did feel sort of like it got swept under the carpet a little bit. I admit that we were partly, you know, as much to blame as anyone else for that, because obviously, you know, we're going to get rid of DPOs and DPIAs. That's going to grab the attention. But it is quite interesting to look into that in greater detail. And this concept of innovation that gets thrown around a lot by the UK government as something that is, you know, so valuable to us. What do we actually mean by that? It's a fair question, but I'm afraid, Steph, I don't have a response. If anyone does want to offer an interpretation, then by all means, please do. The other thing in the chat that I've... Sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was just going to say on that, yeah, before I just move off the DCMS stuff, has anybody actually completed the consultation bit and or sent feedback? I'd be quite interested to... I think we should, and I think the Secretary should. I think we have, or we are doing... in that sense. I just wonder if anybody else has really engaged with any of those consultation processes, and very valid from the point that is made, whether we feedback going, well, when you talk about innovation, what are you actually talking about? And those kind 100%. Of things.
Yeah, 100%. We do intend to. I just I think it's currently sat with me, and I've simply not gotten round to it. What I absolutely love about these sessions, if you'll indulge me, is that you know, the interaction we get in the comments. So in response to what is innovation, Cameron's posted the ICO statement, their comment on it, which I had read previously. But to Angela, innovation simply equals cutting corners, question mark, I love that. Thank you both for that playoff, that contrast. It's fantastic. There's one thing I did want to pick up actually just quickly. Rick, I noticed the bit that you've put in about Microsoft's open source privacy mapping tool. Now, I hadn't seen this, and I'm a little frustrated that I hadn't, because I'm currently doing a data mapping exercise using a particular tool, which I won't name to maintain some illusion of impartiality. But I don't know if you wanted to jump on and just talk about that very quickly, Rick, if you're able to. On a noisy train, that's fine, don't you worry. But yes, just to circle back again, we should absolutely be responding to the consultation, because ultimately, again, this is kind of, I think, part of the issue for us, is that all too often, and it's part of the reason why these sessions can be so refreshing, I feel, is that all too often DPOs, privacy pros, etc., practitioners up and down the country, I think it is quite easy to get really quite isolated at times, because there's still a degree of an adversarial approach within a lot of organizations to the privacy voice in the business, because I still hear it a lot from my clients. You know, we're seen as the people who slow things down, who get in the way, who say no, etc. So still a lot of that going around. And ultimately, you know, unless you've got those networks with other organizations, with other people, you know, it's quite easy to become isolated. And I think that is potentially one of the big risks in relation to this DCMS paper. You know, we're all sat in our own corner, busy, snowed under, trying to deal with SARS. Who's actually going to stand up and say, hang on a second, you know, us practitioners don't agree with this?
No, I think it's a really valid point. And when you were talking about there earlier, I was just kind of reflecting back when I was kind of working in-house and doing this kind of thing in-house. And it can get an awfully lonely place, which is the reason why I quite like this forum that we're running for practitioners and colleagues across the sector to come and join in. It's their forum, it's their session. We can talk about bits that we've planned to talk about. We can talk about bits that the conversation takes us in other directions too. And it's useful to kind of have that, because once you're in that kind of rather lonely place and have nowhere to bounce ideas off or get a little bit of a sanity check in that sense, it can all be awfully difficult in that sense. And then, like you say, balanced with the fact that your workloads are normally through the roof, so you've got every intention to want to respond, to engage with the consultation process, not just on the DCMS, but you maybe fancied joining consultation process and the data sharing code of practice and things like that. It's just trying to find the time to do it and to kind of talk around what the bits and pieces are and the relevant bits in order to kind of formulate your own thought process before you actually give feedback. Because sometimes you might just need that kind of avenue or that that environment to bounce things around, so you clear yourself before you actually submit it to paper.
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't agree more. One thing I did want to just clear up, actually, because my mistake when I was talking about the Microsoft open source privacy mapping tool, Andrew's also added in that CNIL have got one. I misunderstood what that was getting at. I thought it was a data mapping tool, building, you know, your data flows, potentially building Europas. What it actually is a literal privacy framework mapping tool, so or project mapping different international privacy standards. I do apologize, I got the slightly wrong end of the stick on that one. Speaking of which, I think we need to wrap up really, but Cameron's asking about whether the ICO consultation on international transfers conflicts with the DCMS consultation. I think it 100% does, because for having attempted to complete the ICO's template transfer risk assessment start of September, when it was out for consultation, you know, it's just completely, it's chalk and cheese compared to what the DCMS wanted under Oliver Dowden anyway. So I think it absolutely contrasts. And again, this is what we said at the time, probably bad timing on the comms point, because yes, we're trying to make sure that our EU adequacy is maintained, And all of a sudden we've got people saying, well, you know, let's bin that off. Let's go do our own thing. So I think absolutely poorly timed on that front.
Very good. I was wondering whether you would actually say it's poorly timed. Is it actually adequately timed with the ICO stance? If it's different from what the DCMS is, is the ICO taking a stance kind of going, we're not standing up for this, we're going to demonstrate why? That kind of stuff in different matters, not just through the consultation process.
Well, we shall have to see what John Edwards thinks about all that, shan't we? Which is going to be an interesting turn to take. People are having to dive off now, and quite rightly so, because we've already overrun ever so slightly. Not unusual. Dave, any parting thoughts before we do close out the session?
No, I don't think it's been a really great session today. I've enjoyed all the interactions, and thanks for everybody that's unmuted and joined in. My leaving part on this occasion is possibly an apology for the soapbox, and I'll be back to normal next week.
don't you dare go back to normal next week. It's what we're all here for, is the soapbox. thank you very much for that, David. Much appreciated. Thanks to Phil as well, even though he had to dive off halfway through. It's always great to have you both around for these sessions, just to bounce ideas off. Thank you to all those on the session. All contributions, absolutely fantastic. It's always better when we get some good interaction. We know that. You guys know that. So, yeah, hopefully we can keep that going well into future sessions. So thank you all for attending. We will be back next week with a charity sector specific event. We're going to be talking very specifically about re-engaging with lapsed donors. We've actually got a guest speaker on from a partner of ours, No Checks, who have got some experience in the sector. So we're looking forward to speaking to them. But until then, have a very lovely weekend, and we hope to see you all next week. Thank you all, and take care.
Thank you, everybody. Take care now. Bye-bye.